Hello, everyone, and welcome to the holiday, January 6th, the day where we were reminded that, like, we never really had a democracy and we probably won't even have this sham of a democracy for much longer. It's been a year and we're going to look back on it. The we being me, Johnny Derola, and very lucky to be joined on this auspicious day by Anna Kasparian. Anna, welcome to the Damage Report.
Hey, everyone. Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's been a while, but I'm happy to be here.
It has. We are always excited to have you here. And today is a day of amazing synergies. Not only did you decide to come on my show, which happens, you know, only once every few months or so, but we're also going to be doing the main show together later on today. So we're going to try to mix things up. I'm going to try to keep some of my best points for later on. So what the audience is going to be getting now is mostly trash. So get ready for that. But anyway, very excited to do the show with you. Thank you everyone for being here. Over the course of the next 90 minutes, we've got a lot that we're going to be talking about. We're going to be checking in on not only what both Joe Biden and Donald Trump have been saying today about January 6th, but also what is the state of the GOP 1 year later? What has happened to those who turned against Donald Trump after the insurrection? And what is going on with those who stuck with him? I think maybe you can guess, but we're going to look through the evidence together. We've also got Ted Cruz saying something rational, Candace Owens saying something insane, Nate Silver's the craziest guy on Twitter, seemingly as always, and a hockey Good Samaritan. Sports news coming from the Damage Report. You requested it, and soon you'll wish you hadn't. But anyway, feel free to hit the like button, share the stream. That'd be great. Do what the algorithm requires of you. And with that, Anna Kasparian, are you ready to talk about some news?
I'm super ready. Let's do it.
Okay, let's do it. Let's jump into this video.
My fellow Americans, to state the obvious, 1 year ago today, in this sacred place, democracy was attacked, simply attacked. The will of the people was under assault. The Constitution, our Constitution, faced the gravest of threats. Outnumbered in the face of a brutal attack, the Capitol Police, the D.C. Metropolitan Police Department, the National Guard, and other brave law enforcement officials saved the rule of law. Our democracy held. We, the people, endured. We, the people, prevailed.
Okay, so look, there, we're going to have more for you, by the way, from President Biden. There, he's going to be laying the blame, obviously, on Trump. That seems rational. And he's saying that it didn't succeed, the insurrection, after all. You know, the vote was certified. 2 weeks later, Joe Biden was inaugurated. But Anna, to start things off, he gave a very, like, triumphant, victorious speech there. And I feel like that, I get it. I get that we should reassure people a year later that, you know, they didn't succeed right then. But with all that's happened since then, is that the right tone? Like, we won, democracy prevailed, the people succeeded. With all that's happened between last January 6th and this, that to me feels like it's hiding more than it's revealing about the state of American democracy.
I think it's part and parcel of what we've seen in American politics for a very long time, especially with the Democratic Party as of late. It's this real disconnect from what's really happening in the country, especially when it comes to the whole issue of our democracy and how easily the Republican Party has eroded the democratic process on a state level, especially. So there's the issue, of course, of the country just being incredibly divided. And it's gotten worse since January 6th. On the very issue of January 6th, you have a huge portion of the country that will not accept the results of the 2020 election. They genuinely believe that Donald Trump had won, and they believe that they may have to use political, or not even political, they may have to use violence in order to take the country back. In fact, a recent poll showed that the number of Republican voters who think they need to resort to violence has unfortunately climbed to 40%. And so that is, of course, lost in this hopeful, optimistic speech, which, you know, we'll later talk about some of the tough talk he had for Donald Trump. But the other issue is, what about all the voter suppression laws that have passed in these battleground states, places like Georgia, places like Florida? Florida's not really a battleground state at this point, if you ask me. But you get what I'm saying? I mean, it may be true that Biden is president and the election was certified. But at the end of the day, when you look at all the other things that are happening, not in the periphery, but right here, front and center, in terms of the erosion of our democratic process, it's really hard to say that we've prevailed.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe it would be one thing if I don't know, if we gave the speech, me or you or whatever, and we're like, okay, we want to, you know, inspire people, keep them hopeful or whatever. So we're just going to focus on that. That might be okay, because while there's so many more reasons to be terrified, I think, in terms of the laws that have been passed, as you pointed out, the increasing, you know, willingness for, or perhaps desire for political violence on the right, we're not responsible for that. But he's been president during a time when he's leading a party that is asleep at the wheel during this. So it's kind of convenient for him to want to focus on how democracy prevailed and the people are awesome and everything. Why don't you pass a bill to end the practices that have been going on this last year? I'm not saying that Joe Biden unilaterally, or even all of the Democrats, can get the Republicans away from the brink, like them diving over into full on, you know, fascism and wanting their political opponents to be killed. I don't think that that's necessarily within their abilities, but they could pass the bill. They could do something to make it so that we can't necessarily stop the Republicans from dispatching a mob at us. But maybe we can make it less likely that the other side of January 6th, which we all too often forget, which is the political attempt to overturn the results of the election, would be less likely to succeed in the future, because it's looking pretty likely at this point.
Yeah, my main issue with the Democratic Party is that they A, hold the levers of power, and B, don't flex that power. And even when it comes to the future of their own political careers, they're unwilling to do what is necessary. They're unwilling to engage in the difficult fight necessary to pass even a watered down version of the voting and election reform bill that was originally passed in the House. Like, the robust version, that's not going to pass because of the fact that it includes all sorts of campaign finance reform, something that Joe Manchin is against. Joe Manchin, a conservative Democrat in the Senate, comes out with his own pared down version of a Voting Rights Act, and they can't get that passed because it would require them to, at the very least, reform the filibuster. The very filibuster that Biden has been supportive of and has been unwilling to do away with in the context of a social spending package. And so people will come at me and say, no, but Biden says he supports a carve out. Well, yeah, Biden also said that he supported his own Build Back Better agenda, but he didn't fight for it. And the same exact thing is happening right now when it comes to voting rights, when it comes to the legislative filibuster in the Senate that's holding back all legislation that would improve the country.
Yeah. 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 He can say what he wants. Manchin says he wants a separate climate bill. Okay. Right. He said it. What is that worth? Anyway, let's go back to things that are being said. Here is a bit more of Joe Biden's speech where he turns the focus on Donald Trump as the instigator of the insurrection.
And here's the truth. The former president of the United States of America has created and spread a web of lies about the 2020 election. He's done so because he values power over principle, because he sees his own interest is more important than his country's interest, than America's interest. And because his bruised ego matters more to him than our democracy or our Constitution, he can't accept he lost, even though that's what 93 United States senators, his own attorney general, his own vice president, governors and state officials in every battleground state have all said. He lost. That's what 81 million of you did as you voted for a new way forward. He has done what no president in American history, the history of this country, has ever done. He refused to accept the results of an election and the will of the American people.
That is true. Everything that Biden just said there is true. I continue to love the people that were telling us in the lead up to the 2020 election when we were like, hey, so you know, Trump is being fairly clear that if he loses, he's not going to accept it. They're like, you hysterical people, Trump derangement syndrome. Well, it's been a year, and not only does he not accept it, but that's not just like a personal opinion that he has. It's consequential. It has affected the political views of tens of millions of Americans. It is now the default position, as we'll get into later in the show, of virtually every Republican running for office. We were right. It matters that we were right. And the same people that called us crazy then refuse to accept the danger of what's been going on throughout this year. So that's fun. It's great to not have the allies you desperately need when democracy is on the chopping block. But anyway, Anna, before you jump in, that commentary that he just made, laying the blame obviously and appropriately on Donald Trump, is already drawing the sort of responses that you would expect. Brett Baer on Fox says a number of people say there was a choice here to be made, whether Biden was going to stir emotion and stir that pot or talk about moving forward. He tried to cross that bridge, but clearly is taking advantage of the situation. Harris Faulkner says, did he miss an opportunity to bring people together by simply recognizing the pain and leaving the politics out of it? Well, I feel like Trump could have done that on January 6th in the lead up to it. No, it's Joe Biden is tearing us apart, Anna.
Listen, conservatives and these Fox News grifters are gonna do, they're gonna follow the script. This is what their script is. Regardless of what Biden said, they would have had their prepared talking points and all of them would be incredibly critical. Yeah. The fact of the matter is the Republican Party, along with conservative media, do not want to deal with any of the responsibility. They don't want to shoulder the responsibility that they legitimately need to shoulder for their role in what happened that day, for perpetuating the lies about election fraud, for lying about mail-in ballots leading to widespread fraud, an unfounded claim that they continue to repeat to this day. They want to ensure that they don't have to deal with any of the responsibility associated with what happened on January 6th. So hopefully, I mean, I don't have much hope for Biden. I'm just keeping it real. But hopefully Biden doesn't listen to that critique and is willing to continue at least using this rhetoric to call out the Republican Party for what they've engaged in, because it is dangerous. And I can't stand people who minimize what transpired, not just on that day, but what continues to transpire in this country. Again, the erosion of our democratic process. I mean, we've already seen that erosion following two devastating Supreme Court rulings, which has now allowed for unlimited money to be funneled to these politicians in the form of legalized bribes. That's eroded our democracy. All we really have left is our ability to vote and for those votes to count. And what these GOP lawmakers are doing is taking those rights away little by little with all of these laws that create all of these obstacles that make it increasingly difficult for valid, legitimate voters to go out there and cast their ballots. Biden needs to fight. I haven't really seen much of a fight either rhetorically or legislatively, but at least in the very least in this one speech, Biden was willing to say what needed to be said.
Biden willing to do the bare minimum.
Exactly.
That's what it is. That's what it is. Donald Trump has responded to Joe Biden's commentary marking the anniversary of January 6th. Although, spoiler alert, he might be in a little bit of trouble. I'm gonna give you his comments, but understand that he is being attacked not only from former insiders in his administration, which are leaking information about what happened on January 6th, but some of those who rioted on January 6th are not happy with what he's been doing this week to mark that occasion. But first, here is a very small portion of his comments. Much of it you've heard word for word before. It's the same, the diarrhea of the mouth that he always gets up to. But here's a bit. He says, Biden, who is destroying our nation with insane policies of open borders, corrupt capital E elections, disastrous energy policies, unconstitutional mandates, and devastating school closures, used my name today to try to further divide America. This political theater is all just a distraction for the fact Biden has completely and totally failed. Why is it that the unselect committee, you get it? I called it unselect, of totally partisan political hacks whose judgment has long ago been made. Not discussing the rigged presidential election of 2020, it's because they don't have the answers or justifications for what happened. They got away with something, and it is leading to our country's destruction. They all want conversation concerning the election, capital C, canceled. Man, you really can just use canceling for anything.
For anything. For just, anything.
It means nothing.
It's pretty.
But anyway, yes. So, in the immediate aftermath of January 6th, he had to begrudgingly send his mob away after sending them there and saying that he's going to go with them, and he never went. Why doesn't that bother them more that he didn't go? But whatever, he didn't go. So then he sent him away. A couple days after, he put out a statement implying that what had happened was a bad thing. He was sort of forced to. There's a lot of pressure. He was about to be impeached again. But we're a year later, and he's now openly saying it was awesome. They were patriots. It was justified. He's on the Tucker Carlson side of this. It's great that it happened. While at the same time, fans at his rallies are saying they weren't Republicans who were rioting still. We showed you that CNN video of them being interviewed. So that's an amazing thing to hold in your mind simultaneously, that it was great and they were patriots, but also they were damn BLM and Antifas. But anyway, that's what he had to say, or as much of it as I'm willing to read.
First, let me just give you credit for your excellent Trump impression, because most people don't get the breathiness of his rhetoric correct.
The breathiness is critical.
It really is. It always sounds like he just ran a marathon, although most of the time he's just sitting on a couch eating McDonald's, literally. Yeah. Like that's his favorite thing. But also putting that aside, this very clear talking point that we're seeing among conservative talk show hosts and also Donald Trump here of how this is dividing the country. Biden's speech divided the country. No, the country's divided.
Yeah.
Okay? The country's divided. We're pretty damn divided. When you have 40% of Republican voters saying in a recent poll that they may have to resort to political violence to take the country back, country's pretty divided. When you have a huge portion of the country that refuses to accept the legitimate results of the presidential election, country's pretty divided. We're divided. The real question is, are we as American voters, whether we're on the left or the right, going to allow for nefarious political elites to continue tearing us apart? And I don't look, whatever we've been doing so far, and I'm not just talking about people in general, I'm talking about TYT, what our message is, what our project is, It hasn't worked. Okay. And I'm just being open and honest about that. I mean, it's worked in terms of converting some conservatives and some Trump supporters to see the light. But we have to make a point, in my opinion, to reach out to not politicians. I'm talking about actual people in our lives who may be conservative, who may have fallen victim to QAnon conspiracies and all that. We have to make a point to not cut them out of our lives, as difficult as that is, and have calm conversations with them. Because I think one of the things that we're seeing is, because the country is so divided, families are being ripped apart. Friends are no longer friends. And look, I get it. Yeah. It's really difficult. It's really difficult to see a friend of yours kind of go down that rabbit hole, or a family member of yours fall into conspiracy theories and things like that. But cutting them off, I think it makes those conspiracies and that political ideology a bigger part of their identity, and they're never exposed to any opposition to it. Right. So I don't know. I'm trying something different this year. And it kind of started in the middle of last year. And it's to try really hard not to come across as judgmental, just be open with people, honest with people, kind to people. And my hope is we'll start convincing people like, hey, we all want the same things. We might have different solutions, but let's actually debate those among each other in a calm, rational way. And not allow the elite, who are robbing all of us blind, both on the left and the right, to continue dividing us, continue tearing us apart.
I mean, you're trying to be very reasonable. It's difficult.
It's hard.
it's difficult what you're saying, both because it's generally not incentivized. you know, on your own side, and also obviously so difficult on the other side. Because it's not just that the other side is getting, you know, sort of political policy messages that are, you know, the opposite of what we would want. They are being told to believe that we're evil. Like, at the best case scenario, we're commies and BLM terrorists. That's the best case. Worst case, Satanists who eat baby faces. So that makes the job hard, but I appreciate you trying to do it.
No, it makes it hard, but they're gonna keep thinking that about us until they get to actually know us. And I wanna also make a quick distinction, because this is important. I'm talking about the average voter. I'm not talking about nefarious right-wing figures. I'm not talking about like, oh, I'm gonna hit up the Proud Boys or the Boogaloo Boys or some Nazis and try to convince them to come to my side. No, I'm just talking about people who we might know, acquaintances, family members, friends, who might have gotten radicalized online. And I remember getting a tweet from someone who lives in the South, and it's a blue-collared worker. And this individual was convinced that I'm against blue-collared workers. And I was like, blue-collar workers are the heart of America. I have tremendous respect for you and what you do for a living. And he was kind of shocked by that. You know what I'm saying? And it's because he's not exposed to the other side at all. And he just buys the narrative that's being fed to him over and over again in the media filter bubble that he exists in.
Yeah, definitely. So it's certainly worthwhile to try. Okay, with that, there will be more. He'll say more, they'll say more about it. And I'm sure that we'll get to it on the main show. But for now, we are going to take our first break. We have a lot more to get to, so don't go anywhere. Okay, everybody, let's talk about some more stuff. It's been 1 year since the actual January 6th. We're marking that anniversary today. And we thought, let's check in a little bit on the state of Republicans, differentiating between those who took January 6th seriously and who believe there should be consequences for it, and not just consequences for the regular people that have been turned into, you know, zombies and sent to the Capitol, the people who inspired it, versus those who have embraced the same big, you know, election lies that produced January 6th. Well, let's start with those 10 Republicans who actually voted to impeach Donald Trump, because they existed. And it was surprising at the time that there were 10 even in the Republican Party that were willing to impeach him for what he had done. And it hasn't necessarily gone very well for them. Since they cast their impeachment votes, Representatives Anthony Gonzalez of Ohio and Adam Kinzinger of Illinois have both announced their retirements amid death threats from voters and hostility from the rest of their party. So two of those 10 are out, they're done. And there's still time for others to retire, but let's check in with others. Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming, she was considered a star in the House Republican leadership, which is its own problem and indictment of the party. Let's just say that. But now she might as well be a Democrat for all that they care about her. Representatives Jamie Herrera Butler of Washington, Peter Maher of Michigan, and Fred Upton of Michigan have Trump endorsed primary challengers on their heels and uncertain political futures. The party is almost certainly going to drive them out by choosing people who accept whatever lie Donald Trump comes up with on a daily basis. So they haven't chosen to retire, but they might be retired. Four others, John Katko of New York, Dan Newhouse of Washington, Tom Rice of South Carolina, and David Valadao of California, basically don't exist as public figures anymore. They very rarely actually appear in any significant fashion when it comes to the party. They just sort of are out there kind of existing. And I wanted to give you one statement from one. So this is Mr. May here, who previously talked about of having the Trump endorsed primary challenger. He said there's been this waiting game and an arbitrage between an individual's political future and the trajectory of that guy, Trump, assuming the apex has passed. The view among some was that this would be essentially a self-correcting issue and that Mr. Trump's power would fade. I think that's proven overly optimistic. And he says that amidst his own Trump-backed primary challenger. So yeah, 10 decided to do the right thing. And as is so often the case, Anna, in American politics, they have been rewarded in absolutely no way as a result of that.
That's right. You and I often talk about how there is a lack of incentives to be a good person, to do the right thing in various contexts. And unfortunately, this is one of those contexts. With the Republican Party, all the incentives are in the wrong place. And it's to just go along with an incredibly dangerous lie about the election and who actually won it. And it's led to the incitement of violence in this country, political division in this country. It's unfortunate, but this story actually made me realize just how different the Democratic and Republican parties really are. And it's not just about their ideology, it's also about their strategy. In the Democratic Party, what's pretty fascinating is when you have politicians like Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin in the Senate, who are able to serve as massive obstacles in the passage of the Democrats' agenda, you know, with the Build Back Better agenda, with the voting rights bill, all of that, there is no hardball. There are no sticks utilized by, let's say, Joe Biden or the rest of the Democratic caucus. They just kind of go along with what a few corrupt politicians want. Whereas on the right, if you don't go along with what the party demands, you'll be excommunicated.
That's it.
Your political career is over.
Yeah.
And honestly, even though I don't agree with what the Republican Party is doing right now, I have admiration for that kind of strength. I wish that Democrats would use that kind of strength for good.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, not in the same way. And look, sometimes they use that pressure, you know, like Rahm Emanuel under Obama and stuff. Yeah, but against progressive challengers, against any critique of how the party is betraying its voters, betraying its campaign promises, it'll use it against those people. Look at the, you know, the progressives who are willing to vote against the bipartisan infrastructure bill. They were criticizing them. Just, you know, not those who are literally stopping the president from achieving his agenda. Yeah, the pressure is not there, but they are certainly feeling it if you were one of those who criticized Donald Trump. Many Republicans have stuck with Donald Trump following last January 6th and are in fact embracing his lies, seemingly as the core of their political ideology and identity. And this is nowhere more true than in those who are running to become secretaries of state in states around the country. NPR has found 15 different Republicans who've denied or cast doubts on the 2020 election results running to be the chief election officer in 12 different states, including six of the seven states that Biden had his slimmest victory margins in, which means that if they win, the attempts in 2020 to overturn at the individual state level or altogether at the federal level election results, that didn't work in 2020. Because they didn't have the right people. They are putting those people in every election in the interim. And I want to give you some examples of those provided by NPR. So in Georgia, they have two. Jody Heiss objected to the certification in Congress on January 6th. She's Trump endorsed. So she literally tried to overturn the election federally and now might be in charge of Georgia's election for the next one. She might not actually win the primary, but she might be beat by David Bell Isle, who himself believed that Georgia's results shouldn't be certified. So they're duking it out to be the one who stops democracy in Georgia. That's fun. In Arizona, you have State Representative Mark Finchem, who attended the Stop the Steal rallies in January. Like, he was literally there, spoke of election fraud in Virginia before that state's governor's race. He's Trump endorsed. So again, initially Trump was saying those people at the rallies are Antifa or BLM, they're not Republicans. But if it turns out that some of them are Republicans, they have my endorsement. But again, he might not win, but he might lose to Shauna Balk, who introduced a bill that would give legislators the power to overturn an election. So just overturn the whole thing. And then that way, you don't even need to have the Secretary of State's office. If you just have the majority in the legislature, you can do it. In Nevada, Jim Marchant says that the 2020 election was stolen from him too, by the way. He ran for something and he lost. So he was robbed, Trump was robbed. And these are all incredibly important states. Like, they want to make it impossible for them to lose these critical states. And I'm not saying that getting these secretaries of state is the only thing you need to do, but they are doing this work. In this last year, where the Democrats are mostly just sitting by and watching what happens, Republicans are suppressing the vote, they're stopping mail-in ballots, and they're also taking control of county elections boards as well as secretaries of state positions, Anna.
Yeah, the GOP has been incredibly organized, not just on the issue of voter suppression and the erosion of our democracy, but they've been organized for decades in ensuring that our judicial system is just completely filled with conservative activist judges. And we're not seeing similar activity on the left, which is concerning. We're not seeing it on a local level, and we're not seeing it on a federal level in response to the very voter suppression that they themselves talk about. They talk about it in their campaigns, they talk about it in their press conferences, they talk about how much of a threat it is in their social media activity. So they understand the threat, but they refuse to do the work necessary to respond to it. They refuse to engage in the fight necessary to defeat the behavior that we're seeing on the right. Yeah. And that's the thing that really concerns me, right? Oftentimes we get criticism for being too critical of the left or being too critical of the Democratic Party. But the fact of the matter is, Republicans tell us who they are every day. They're transparent about it. Whereas Democrats position themselves as the individuals who are poised to fight back against the Republican Party. But they don't do it. They don't do it.
They
present themselves as something that does not bear it, that doesn't actually play out in real life. And that's what frustrates me the most about the Democratic Party. They're the ones we're supposed to turn to as the individuals who are supposed to protect our democracy and fight back, but they're not fighting back.
Yeah. No, you're totally right. And we were alluding to that earlier, that we can maybe get the speech out of them. And there are certainly some Democrats that want to pass a bill, but never a critical mass, which is always the way that it seems to work out on so many of these different issues. So yeah, those are the Republicans. The ones who are critical of him are being weeded out. And those who have nothing to offer and don't even try to offer anything other than Trump got stolen and also let's go Brandon, they're gonna be doing quite well in these elections. So they will soon be in positions of power. Imagine if it hadn't been Raffensperger at that point. And by the way, he's gone crazy in his own way in relation to elections since then, but he did the right thing in Georgia back in 2020. Well, next time it won't be him, it'll be one of these crazies.
We are approaching a solemn anniversary this week, and it is an anniversary of a violent terrorist attack on the Capitol, where we saw the men and women of law enforcement demonstrate incredible courage, incredible bravery, risk their lives to defend the men and women who serve in this Capitol.
Okay, so what you just heard from Senator Ted Cruz was simultaneously a very rational thing to say, the best thing that he's ever said, and also apparently the most dangerous thing that Ted Cruz has ever said for his own political career, because despite the fact that he just said they were courageous, they were attacked, we know it was true. Dozens and dozens and dozens of cops were attacked and hospitalized. Some died as a result of that attack. He's just acknowledging that the right is not happy with Ted Cruz at all. That clip that you saw actually was not the raw C-SPAN footage. It was used on last night's Tucker Carlson, and he went on to have this to say about Ted Cruz's comment.
Everyone who's conservative appreciates Ted Cruz. You may not like him, but you gotta appreciate him. He's legitimately smart. He's one of the more articulate people to serve in the Congress, maybe the most articulate. He doesn't use a single word by accident. Every word Ted Cruz uses is used intentionally. He's a lawyer. He described January 6th as a violent terrorist attack. Of all the things that January 6th was, it was definitely not a violent terrorist attack. It wasn't an insurrection. Was it a riot? Sure. It was not a violent terrorist attack. Sorry. So why are you telling us that it was, Ted Cruz? And why are none of your Republican friends who are supposed to be representing us and all the people who've been arrested during this purge saying anything? What the hell's going on here? You're making us think maybe the Republican Party is as worthless as we suspected it was. That can't be true. Reassure us, please, Ted Cruz.
It's just show, like, you know, you might believe that because he has millions of viewers that his show is like, there's gotta be something there. But no, it's pathetic. He just didn't. No, they say it's this. I don't think it is. So why is he saying that? It's so inherently condescending, not to the opposition, but to the people that willingly watch it. I don't understand why they do that. But he is not happy at all. And he's not the only one, by the way. In addition to Tucker Carlson making a gigantic deal out of Ted Cruz's comments, you have tweets. And by the way, like, it is very possible in stories like this to just pluck a couple of randos or whatever. These are tweets that are all getting incredible play on the right, by the way. Thousands of likes and retweets. Eric Matheny says, I don't demand 100% agreement from my leaders. I can and often do disagree on some issues and still support them. But calling patriotic Americans terrorists isn't a mere policy difference. That's where we part ways. Ted Cruz is relegated to Lindsey Graham status. Damn, that's a burn. Again, they're patriotic Americans, except when they're secretly not conservatives at all. They're not Trump supporters. It's one or the other at all times simultaneously. Susan St. James says, Ted Cruz has done permanent damage to his political career. He should apologize. Laverne Spicer says, I'm a big fan of Ted Cruz on most days, but the only terrorist attack on this nation in connection with the 2020 election was November 3rd, 2020. But my favorite commentary about this comes from this rando, Ken Klippenstein, who says, not a fan of Ted Cruz, but I'm hopeful he'll rise to the historic occasion tomorrow, the anniversary of January 6th, and fave another porn tweet. We'll have to wait and see. There's still a lot of day left, Anna. But were you surprised by?
That's such a Ken Klippenstein tweet. It's totally like classic Ken Klippenstein.
Totally. So were you surprised by what Ted Cruz had to say or the reaction it's getting?
I was surprised. I felt like there was going to be some sort of catch. I was waiting for that twist, but it never came. And wow, Ted Cruz actually said something accurate, rational. I mean, I actually went back as you were presenting the story to see how Ted Cruz voted to certify the election on January 6th after the riots took place. You know, I don't know why, but I was under the assumption that he actually voted against certifying the election. But no, he voted to certify the election. And remember, this is following his perpetuation that of that big lie that the election was stolen. So it's funny because I always enjoy seeing politicians try to straddle an issue where they try to appease or appeal to like the extreme elements of their party, while also trying like behind the scenes to do the right thing, because they'll eventually get caught. They'll eventually, you know, deal with the backlash for trying to straddle. And I both appreciate the rational message that we heard from him, but I also appreciate the fact that he's getting dunked on.
Yeah, I'm fine with it, and he deserves it. You know, acknowledging a terrorist attack doesn't absolve him of all the nonsense he's done. And you're right to acknowledge his vote. But let's also bear in mind that he was doing a bit of straddling himself on January 6th. I mean, he was leading the like opposition to certification. Okay, maybe he voted the right way finally and has been a little bit of critical of Trump. But he also played that game of, hey, maybe elections are optional, maybe it just really comes down to the Senate. Like he was a very active participant in that at the same level of someone like a Josh Hawley. And he experienced a lot of criticism in the wake of January 6th, people calling for him to be taken out of the Senate and all that as well. So good job on this commentary. The turn that you expected could be coming in a couple of days. I mean, Tucker Carlson seems to believe it was a dangerous riot. He just blames it on the FBI. So maybe he'll find some way to act right from their point of view.
On some days, let's just be clear about Tucker Carlson. The narrative changes depending on which day of the week it is. So on some days it was Antifa. On other days it was the FBI. On some days it was Trump supporters, but what they were doing was patriotic.
Yeah.
You know, it really 100%. Depends on the day of the week.
Yeah, or even the segment he's on, because there was a great tweet going around of two screenshots from one Tucker Carlson earlier this week. And it was him criticizing Joe Biden for wearing a mask and then criticizing AOC for not wearing a mask on the same episode of his show.
Amazing.
Yeah, you've got to have severe brain worms to not have a problem with that. And apparently there are millions lining up to demonstrate that that is the case. I want to give you some information about the protests that have been going on in Kazakhstan recently, as well as the violent, in fact, murderous response to those protests. But a major caveat before we launch into this, as I try to always, I am not an expert on this region, on Kazakhstan specifically, or on its politics. So take everything I say with a grain of salt and be sure to do your own research. I just want to make sure that you do know about what's going on. And more importantly, my producer Sophie wants to make sure that you know about this particular story. So she did a great job of producing it. Any misinformation that I spread is all on me, not on her. So let's just bear that in mind. But the protests have been going on for some time, and we'll tell you about the impetus of the protests. What you should understand is that recently, the reaction to the protests has become significantly more violent, with a number of people being injured. And in fact, it looks like dozens of people being killed by security forces. So hundreds injured, at least dozens killed. But let's go back to the beginning. Anger boiled over when the government of Kazakhstan lifted price caps for liquefied petroleum gas, frequently referred to by its initials LPG, a low carbon fuel that many Kazakhs use to power their cars. But the protests, despite being centered on that, have more deep-seated roots, including anger at social and economic disparities, aggravated by a raging pandemic, as well as the lack of real democracy. Sounds like America, actually. The average salary in Kazakhstan is the equivalent of $570 a month, according to government statistics, but many people earn far less. So there are a lot of socioeconomic and public health issues that are also adding to the tension over this increase in the price of LPG. About 1,000 people have reportedly been injured so far, with 400 being treated in hospital and 62 in intensive care. Protesters targeted the mayor's office in Almaty, which I believe is the capital of Kazakhstan, and Kazakhstan's main airport, while water cannons were used against protesters in the western city of Aqtobe. So that's what's been going on. The government response has been multifaceted. So on the one hand, they've used things like instituting a state of emergency, blocking social networking sites. This is a move that we've seen in a lot of more authoritarian countries, blocking chat apps, including Facebook, WhatsApp, Telegram, and even the Chinese app WeChat. Public protests without permits were already illegal. It was also initially conceded to a few of the demonstrators' demands, dismissing the cabinet and announcing the possible dissolution of parliament, which would result in new elections. But despite that, there has still been unrest. You can see here a statue of, I believe, the previous president being knocked down there. Fires in a government building as well. And then the security forces come in and kill dozens of people. And as of right now, what are being described as Russian-led alliance troops have moved into Kazakhstan. And so they're calling them a peacekeeping force.
Oh, no.
We'll see about that. Again, I am not an expert on this region or its politics or its history, but I also know how these things sort of go generally. And not looking like this is going to result in a more peaceful or gentle treatment of the protesters or necessarily giving into their demands any more readily. But all that said, Anna, what do you think?
Well, I'm noticing a trend in many countries, especially Latin American countries, that have actually moved further to the left in recent elections. And it's a response to the inequality that the people of Kazakhstan are now protesting about. It's the very same socioeconomic issue that, you know, I think I wish we saw a lot more political activity in our own country about. Obviously, I'm not advocating for violence or anything like that. But whenever you see these types of demonstrations happen, whether it be the Yellow Vest movement in France, whether it be the protests that went down in Colombia recently, the heart of the matter is the fact that, you know, you have politicians who continue proposing or passing regressive taxation that continues to harm the working class in these various countries. And it's both inspiring to see people rise up and demand better in the Latin American countries that I'm thinking about right now, whether it's Chile, whether it's Brazil, which is about to have an election this year. You know, there's this movement to the left because there's this understanding that the right wing, despite whatever populist message they might try to use for campaigning purposes, has no interest in fighting for workers, has no interest in looking out for the common man. And so this could really go in a terrible direction. I'm not happy to see that Russia's getting involved in this. I don't really trust the intentions of the Russians here. But I do think that what the demonstrators are voicing here is a legitimate concern, not just in Kazakhstan, but in many countries across the globe. Yeah. What's also relevant is how the United States responds to it, how the US media responds to it, because what I'm noticing in terms of, let's say, coverage of what's happening in Latin American countries right now is this very real fear among both American politicians and journalists in regard to what leftism means for the future of American alliances, because one of the other rising powers in this country, in this world, of course, is China. And you already have the elite in the United States concerned that all these countries that are now moving to the left are going to create alliances with China as opposed to the United States. And the real question is, why would they do that? Could it be because every time, especially in Latin American countries, we have the rise of leftist leaders, the United States comes in and orchestrates a coup? You know what I'm saying? So I think this is a fascinating story, and you know, we should definitely keep our eyes on it. But solidarity and more power to those who are speaking out against the inequality in their country.
Exactly. Yeah, definitely. And if you are interested in this, please, again, do your own independent research and you can find out more. It's a fast developing situation. So that's also true. And to demonstrate my previous point about me not being an expert, Sophie has advised me that Almaty is not the capital. It's one of the biggest cities. It used to be the capital. It's not the capital anymore. So apologies for that. Again, always, especially in international stories, do your own research. And thank you, Sophie, for all your work on this. Okay, we have only a few more minutes. Let's jump into this last one. Quick story. So let's jump into this. COVID cases are obviously rapidly rising around the country. Over a million cases in one day reported this week. We're now at 700,000 and 800,000 virtually every day. And Florida, as in previous waves, has not been immune from that. They've been hit incredibly hard. And yet for weeks, DeSantis was gone. Governor Ron DeSantis couldn't be found, and it was not helping him politically. The Democrats there were making a big deal out of it, and yet he would not show his face. So that leads people to wonder why. Why during this horrible pandemic would he suddenly disappear? Well, he is back now. On Wednesday, he gave a speech in Florida to announce nearly $10 million would be awarded to support semiconductor and other tech manufacturing. But here's the thing, as he was doing that, he had to speak. And that apparently was causing a bit of an issue for him. So we're going to show you a little bit of a video. We want you to listen to the governor.
I've expanded our manufacturing footprint in the state of Florida, and we want to continue to be able to do that as we go forward. Semiconductors are a huge issue. If you look at how the supply chain works, we are overly dependent on foreign nations, including Taiwan, which is a good ally of ours, but which is one that, which is one that is under really serious pressure from the Communist Party of China. And
so look, many people have noted that he doesn't sound like himself there immediately following a weeks long disappearance from the media. Anna, what do you make of it?
He sounds like he's sick. He definitely sounds like he's sick. Either that or he's emotional. There's no reason to believe he's emotional. He sounds like he's sick. Yeah. I hope he's taken a COVID test. And I hope that he's forthright in regard to what the result of that test is. He sounds sick.
He definitely sounds sick. Well, look, and you rightly laid out, there are at least two plausible explanations. One is that he's on the tail end of a pernicious respiratory illness. You know, but what is the likelihood of that in Florida? The other is that dude's dog better have just died, because he is about to break out in tears amidst talking about semiconductor grants, which doesn't make any sense unless something really traumatic happened. Okay, and if that's the case, then I'll take back what I've said. But that dude sounded like he was either about to start to cry or that he was having difficulty breathing enough to speak about semiconductors. So you do the math. But what we know we're not gonna get is clarification. They're not gonna be honest. You know, he's been better than some Republicans, at least in terms of not saying, hey, vaccines are gonna kill you. But he is not forthright. He's not going to admit that he got sick. And especially if he was gone for weeks as a result of a COVID case, it doesn't seem like it was an especially mild case that he had. Revealing that might help people in Florida. Like, oh my God, this guy that I respect, he got really sick. Maybe I should take this seriously. But to do that and potentially hurt your political standing amongst the Republicans, you'd have to have actual compassion. And Ron DeSantis is notably lacking in that. Any final thoughts, Anna?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you wholeheartedly on that. And what's been sobering is just seeing politicians really put their own narcissistic, you know, political ambitions before human lives. Prioritizing themselves above all else, even in the middle of a pandemic. It just shows you, you know, the way our politics works. I just think that our system incentivizes the worst people to run for Congress and to run for public office. And we got to go back to thinking of these positions as positions that, you know, serve the public interest. These are supposed to be public servants. Exactly. And what I've seen with these lies and all of the, you know, disgusting politics surrounding the pandemic just really shows you how broken things are.
You're totally right. And perhaps no more so than Florida on a number of these different issues.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.